Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. And we spend this next half an hour with you at 410-319-8888 and tweeting us at Mark Steiner and emailing us at talk@steinershow.org. Looking at what happened at the Republican convention last night. Reverend Kevin Slayton from the pastor of New Waverly United Methodist Church and president of the Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance joins us here in studio by phone. We have Zoe Carpenter, the nation's assistant Washington editor, and Charles Ellison, political strategist and host of the Also Important WEA and national correspondent for the WEA. Welcome. Good to have all of you with us.
Hey, good afternoon. Hey, thanks so much, Charles. Man.
Zoe, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good to have you with us. And I watched part of it, a lot of it last night. And it is. Well, so let me start with you as a political observer for Nation. Are you there or are you in New York?
I'm actually on the West Coast right now, but I am watching and reading.
As far away from Cleveland as you can be.
Pretty much. We have a whole team of reporters and editors there, and fortunately I was spared this time.
But let me just, it's really like it's a spectacle in many ways.
It is a spectacle. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say just from the people in the very beginning shouting, floor vote, to Donald Trump coming out, to the two guys from Benghazi, veterans who were there for a long time, giving a blow-by-blow description to the chance for Hillary for prison. It's interesting. I mean, it's a very strange thing.
Well, it's not only strange, but it's really remarkable. On the one hand, Donald Trump is a reality TV star, so I think some amount of the spectacle itself is not surprising. But what I was really struck by was how grim everything was, and the sense of impending apocalypse is really striking. Compared to someone like Nixon, who used a similar race-baiting and fear-mongering strategy, but he also painted an aspirational view of America, and there was this positive idea about where, about the American dream and things like that. And I felt like we heard very little of that positive vision last night, and it was all this dark, grim tone, all of this death, sort of using these people who had lost family members. So that's what really struck me.
And I think, Charles, one of the things that also happened, picking up what Zoe said, was that there was a piece, I think it was the Huffington Post this morning or last night, where the leaders of the Trump campaign were saying we're building this campaign on Nixon's 68 campaign.
Right, which is, one, we shouldn't be surprised by the spectacle. I totally agree with Trump's reality show background. He did sort of forewarn us, his campaign chair, his campaign senior leadership, warning us that, hey, this is going to be new. This is going to be a fresh, unorthodox sort of convention. But on the same note, conventions are always a spectacle. But there was a bit of surrealness to what was going on last night. And basically the RNC folks in the Republican rank and file that are there in Cleveland, even some of those who aren't in Cleveland, just accepting that, well, this is what we're going to sort of, this is what we're going to have going into November. This is what we're sort of stuck with here. One of the other things that I kind of noticed too was just how there was just sort of this whole barbarians at the gate sort of at the gates mentality that was running, that was sort of rampant through the RNC last night, through the first night, and just sort of setting the tone. And yes, they're trying to capture what happened in 1968. That's how Nixon, he won on that law and order message. He won on the fear of this new sort of multicultural America, and that's something that they were definitely running with. I mean, you saw that in a lot of speeches, whether it was Rudy Giuliani or even, someone like an African-American like Sheriff David Clark out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, kind of driving that theme and figuring that this is what we're going to use to beat Democrats in November.
Kevin, what's your take as one of the barbarians? I'm just teasing, that, man.
But I agree with that. What stood out for me was a real lack of intellect. There seemed to be absolutely no intellect on display at almost any level. And it was sort of disappointing as an American citizen to see the visible lack of diversity. I mean, the Republican Party is trying to, say that it wants to reach out and be more inclusive, et cetera, et cetera. But it was so far from that. It was really, it was horrible to watch.
Well, you know, let's think about where this might be taking this, us politically. And let me just posit this and start with Zoe. I mean, I think that, around this table, I perhaps am the only one old enough to have been at and remember the 1964 Democratic Convention, but I was there with Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And one of the things that struck me about thinking about this history, that also at that same time that the majority of people who voted for the Civil Rights Bill in Congress at that time were Republicans, not Democrats. Mm-hmm. And that was also the convention that the Republicans held where the conservative movement, even though Gold War lost the election, wasn't a loss for conservatives. It was solidifying a movement that they were building. And then I recall remembering Lyndon Baines Johnson saying when he signed the bills that we have just handed over the South to Republicans for the next generation. But he may have had that wrong. We're looking at a sea change and a real divide that has come about, and the divide is even more glaring, I think, in the last 15 years, 16 years of this century. And Zoe, I just think that I'm trying to look at this convention in that context. Zoe?
Yeah, you know, I'm in my late 20s, so I don't have that.
Right.
I have a pretty different historical memory. I think what I find really interesting, if we look at the trajectory of the Republican Party, is that only last year the Republican Party was talking about prison reform and was talking about criminal justice reform much more than it was talking about this sort of quote-unquote law and order and the broken windows style of thing. Rudy Giuliani would not have been their law and order spokesperson at the convention a year ago, I don't think. And now those calls for reform and have completely shifted back in the other direction. So I think we've really seen the pendulum shift back towards perhaps the trend that you were outlining in terms of the Goldwater movement.
Charles, what were you about to say? I can't hear you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because it's sort of this digging in of ideological heels. And so, you know, whereas I could see where you're kind of headed at assessment, Mark, where there's sort of a feeling that maybe, maybe a year ago, and Zoe too, I see where she's headed with that, you know, maybe a year ago probably would have been, you know, sort of this reverse trajectory for the Republican Party or some hope that maybe there would be some progressive penetration of the party machine, so to speak. That's not happening. In fact, it's essentially the RNC brass, folks like Reince Priebus, essentially accepting the fact that it's not only become even more ultra-conservative in terms of the messaging and the thematics, but it's become very ethno-nationalist. We saw a lot of ethno-nationalism pretty much right on the cusp of just open, but bold-faced white supremacy type messaging and demagoguery that was on display at the RNC last night. And it was very, very disturbing.
Charles, let me ask you this question. So I'm going to get you all to comment on this before I have another subject here. But so, can you describe more specifically what struck you as that, so we can talk about it? What are you referring to?
I mean, just in terms of, you know, definitely not just kind of the outright, white power type language that we may have seen employed by white supremacist groups, but I mean that ethno-nationalism in terms of that, you know, how America used to be. I mean, some of the language that was being employed by folks like Rudy Giuliani, by folks, you know, even, you know, some of the language from folks like David Clark, and even the black gentleman who lost his son to an immigrant, you know, even there was just sort of this sort of, you know, setting this line in the sand, you know, building this ideological wall before they build the real wall if they do win in November. You saw a lot of that, you know, on display and just sort of throughout some of the speeches and even to a certain degree. I mean, you could even feel it. You know, some folks were kind of saying you could kind of feel it in the tone, even though she kind of lifted and cribbed Michelle Obama's speech. You kind of feel it in the tone of Melania Trump's speech to a certain degree, or in the way at least people were responding to it, you know, because it was sort of like, okay, we're not accepting of immigrants of color, but, you know, hey, we're more than happy to open up our arms and embrace the Eastern European immigrant. You know, that's fine. We can go ahead. She's cool because she's a white immigrant. So, you know, that, it was some of that kind of ethno-nationalism that was on display. It was just frankly, after a while, it just became a bit tiring. And it became a bit nauseating because you're just really worried about, okay, where is this going to head, and what does this mean if Trump were to win on November 8th?
Zoe? Or
after that, if he actually tried to carry through these policies, can you imagine actually trying to deport 11 million people and what that would look like? I think it's... it's not only horrifying ideologically, but the practicalities are very scary.
I'm at a complete loss, Mark, with this debate, particularly for my generation. I tend to hope that as a society we're getting better, and the more we're exposed to creates better opportunities for us to be better, but. Everything I see here that I've seen just in the past 24 hours seems like we are headed for a really, really horrible finish line. I don't know what way to the finish line. Should he win, you know, what happens to us as a society? What happens to – I mean, most of the speech leading up to his wife's speech – in many ways, as the gentleman said, it was an antagonist. It was sort of reaching and scratching the surface of some things that really sort of went against immigration. And then here this woman emerges, and it's like, okay, she's okay. So we'll start to paint the lines of who fits in, what it is to be an American. You know, let's start sort of the diagnosis of who can lay claim to this, who has the right to this. Who's in, who's out, but still, every time you pan away, and on these screens, there is nothing that reflects the America, the community that I know. And if this is to be the America that we want the rest of the world to see, we could be in huge trouble.
Folks, did you watch last night? Following this, we want to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888. You can email us, talkatsteinershow.org, tweet us, as you've been doing here today, at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We want to hear your ideas about what's going on. And I wish some of our Republican friends were on the show today. They're not, but that they will be. And I think that it's interesting how so many people who have been commentators on this program, who are conservatives and are Republicans, are either not at the convention or are having a very difficult time saying I could support Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think the idea of me having a cookout for Mark Steiner at my house, and when you came, I wasn't there, you know, that's pretty huge. Like, you know, yeah, Mark, here's the living room, here's the kitchen, you have access to everything here, but I'm going to step away for a while.
Right.
Call me when you're done, and don't worry about it, we got it.
But I think there was something. I mean, I you got me being lost for words, Kevin. I got your disease right now. But I just think that when you think about where we are, you think about the fact that Donald Trump is the candidate of a major political party in America for president of the United States. Some, at least from my perspective, and you're not supposed to use this guy as a show host, but I do it anyway, especially on certain occasions. Mm-hmm. That clearly doesn't have a great deal of substance, that is a reality TV show star, that is not that deep a thinker. Mm. Not that you have to be a deep, deep thinker to be president. Every president has not been a deep thinker, whether you agree with their politics or not. But is possible that he and Governor Spence may become the president and vice president of the United States. Now, there are a lot of issues with Hillary Clinton. We've talked about them on this air for a long time.
Charles. Just looking at it real quick from another perspective here, but in some ways, it's not so surprising that Trump reached it has come this far. I mean, he essentially grasped, you know, he may not on the surface seem that smart of a guy. You know, he may not seem like the sharpest tool in the shed because he's employing, you know, sort of fifth grade elementary speak. But, I mean, he's a master strategist, and he noticed that there is a chaos electorate right now that's going on. That's why, to some degree, I mean, as I was watching some of the debates and the chaos erupt on the convention floor before everything started, as it was kind of, you know, the delegates were going back and forth with RNC brass about the rules, and the Never Trump folks were trying to gain some traction. A lot of it still seemed, on some levels, a bit staged. Because, you know, in Trump's mind and his team's mind, they love that kind of chaos. They're like the Incredible Hulk, you know, that feeds off that kind of angry energy, and they just get bigger and bigger and greener and greener. And that's something that he thrives on, and that's something he also notices that the electorate's been kind of like that, particularly since the election of President Obama, and that it's something that he can go the distance with. So, you know, it's kind of, looking at it from that perspective, I mean, that's what's so, you know, frightening about kind of where we are at this point, and we have to sort of start recognizing that there are, that even though, you know, we talk a lot about the folks that aren't there in Cleveland, a lot of Republicans that aren't openly embracing him, still in poll after poll, you know, you still have nearly three quarters of Republican voters, you know, particularly on issues like foreign policy, particularly on issues like terrorism, embracing Donald Trump, or feeling like, okay, I'm satisfied. You know, it's not the ideal candidate, it's not my ideal nominee, but I still embrace him. I'm going to go ahead and vote and support him on November 8th.
Zoe?
Well, and on that note about it not being so surprising that he has that level of support, you know, the Republican Party has spent, in some ways, the last several decades, but really since 2010, telling their constituents that the problem is government, that the answer is the private sector, and that the other problem is immigrants. And so I don't know why it's sad, but it's not so surprising that someone who is distinctly not from the government, part of the government apparatus or part of the political hierarchy, someone who preaches the gospel of the private sector, and someone who is rabidly anti-immigrant, has become the standard bearer for the party. And that his sort of dumbed down language is appealing. You know, we've also spent the last couple of decades destroying the public education system. So he is the culmination of a conservative project. He just has gotten out of the bottle, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So you also have, let's talk about Cleveland for a moment. There are demonstrations taking place in Cleveland. Zoe, I know you all have been covering them. There are also the police coming out, kind of out in mosque. In almost robot in the robot uniforms, and calling for people not to suspend the right to carry laws, in Cleveland this moment. There's a whole piece outside that I think is not being covered very deeply.
Mm-hmm. And certainly there's prospect for that to blow up in a really bad way. The Cleveland Police Department, for example, has received about $20 million worth of extra police equipment, much of it military grade. And we don't know exactly what equipment they have or how they're going to use it, but you could see a scenario where the tensions are running really high and you have a police department with all of this equipment, and, you know, we wonder how well they're really trained to diffuse tensions rather than stoke them. So I think that's certainly one of the stories to follow.
And quite frankly, the scene on the inside was probably just far more interesting than anything that was happening outside.
Interesting to who?
To the media.
Right. The Black Lives Matter movement was being attacked in some ways by Donald Trump the other night.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of subtext of his comments were they're partially at fault for the killings of the police, and we have to watch them.
Mm-hmm.
And if this explodes outside of Cleveland, it will be. You're seeing the kind of result of this in terms of the latest polling. And polling, people change all the time between now and Election Day.
Right.
But the polling clearly is showing at the moment that Hillary is still ahead, but that she has lost a lot more white voters at this moment than one would have expected.
Right. That sort of message works, that law and order message, that message where you're linking the tragedies that have happened in Dallas and Baton Rouge to sort of this general sense that there is a almost total collapse in security, in domestic security in the United States. And you know, what's funny is that folks being really, whether it's in the convention or whether it's in sort of surrogate conservative media throughout, very easy for them to refer to folks who, you know, what, you know, they were wrong. Micah Johnson was wrong. The other cat in Baton Rouge was wrong. But, you know, they're very quick to classify them as terrorists. Not so quick when Dylann Roof did, you know, sort of a similar thing in Charleston. Or very slow to assign that sort of classification to a lot of these patriot militia groups that are out there. So, you know, you do see that, you know, the breakdown of law and order in society being directly linked to the growth, the rapid demographic changes that are taking place, and to, you know, the growth, the metastasizing of this Black Lives Matter movement. You know, that direct link is there.
So one of the things that also struck me about last night, I just was taking some notes here, is that, you know, when you see the people who really were in pain, mothers, fathers, brothers and sisters, that were killed by, you can see, killed by brown people, killed by illegal aliens, the calls about radical Islamic terrorism. When Pat Smith says that her son was killed in Benghazi, "I blame Hillary Clinton personally for the death of my son," she said, her son Sean in Benghazi. People chanting that, you know, that Hillary for prison, having these three black speakers saying "Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter." I mean, that so people want to focus on, the media wants to focus on Melanie Trump, is that her name, right? Mm-hmm. Melania Trump, on her maybe taking some lines from Michelle Obama. But the story I think that was important, that some other people have written about in the nation, some other places, is that story that we need to kind of analyze over and understand what that means.
In many ways, I think that's even more disappointing, because in all of those cases, I think many of those persons were manipulated. I think they were manipulated. The brother that talked about his son being shot in L.A., just the cadence of the reading and how the rhetoric sort of flowed, it was again, one of those disappointing things. But I think ultimately they create this stew that allows for folks to be so committed in this spirit of just pure anger and ignorance, that we keep wondering how it is that he overcomes these major hiccups. Mm-hmm. And it's that's what they hold on to. So screw what he does. I was telling a friend, I can just imagine if Obama ran for office and his wife's name was, you know, some African name, and she spoke with a heavy African accent. Jesus Christ. I mean, what would have been the response? But they've built up so much this. Hate does that. Hate does that to you.
And Zoe, before we have to take a break, why don't you chime in on your thoughts on what I just said?
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, all those personal stories and what you referred to as manipulation, I think that really reflects that we've entered a post-truth or a post-fact phase of American politics, in the sense that all of those stories were true, in the sense that, yes, those people were killed by undocumented immigrants, but the way that the RNC used them to make a larger claim about the danger of immigration, that's not factually borne out by any of the data. So we have this, the blowing up of a specific incident. On the other hand, the fact that two military veterans just committed murders against police officers, no one is saying that we should judge all military veterans as being crazy or dangerous. And in fact, we should be careful not to stereotype military veterans that way. So you really have the focus on a specific narrative that isn't borne out by the larger truth. And unfortunately, people are willing to just slot these little incidences into a broader narrative that they want to believe in, which, you know, is that undocumented immigration is it's an easier way to explain economic problems, for example, than to talk about neoliberalism and all the complicated macro forces.
And then the exploitation from my standpoint is that you take that path down sort of denigrating immigration, but your keynote speaker in her speech says, you know, I became a citizen in 2006.
But you know, that's what's been going on for a long time. I mean, let's sort of, you know, keep it real here. I mean, is the society has always embraced white culpability or white flaws or white mistakes. So, you know, for example, if roles had been reversed, Melania Trump had been Michelle Obama last night, you would not hear mainstream media organizations saying, oh, it's just very similar. Oh, here's the context of her speech, and when you compare it to Michelle Obama's, or just this general sort of sense throughout the past year of looking at Donald Trump campaign, we've allowed him to sort of get away with all of these outrageous statements, these what are seemed or perceived as gaffes, what are perceived as gaping flaws or mistakes. That's generally speaking, that's how society's always been, as far as its treatment of high profile white public leaders. I mean, but when you have, you know, sort of the same, when you have black public officials, you have somebody like a President Obama or someone of color who commits those same acts, everyone's just outraged or in aghast, you know, just sort of in horror that they would actually commit such an act. So, you know, all of that's kind of coming to a head, too.
So, Charles Ellison, I want to thank you for being with us. We've got to take a break here and get to our next segment. Charles Ellison, national correspondent for WEA, Ellison Port here on Sunday nights on WEAA, the Reverend Kevin Slayton from New Waverly United Methodist Church and head of the Ministerial Alliance here in Baltimore. Zoe Carpenter, the nation's assistant Washington editor. Thank the three of you so much for the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
And we'll take a short break and come back, and we'll be joined by Kalima Young and Dr. Desiree Melton as we take what will be the beginning of an ongoing look at rape culture in our world and what it means. Stay with us.